This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. A recent analysis by the New York Times found that this year's congressional elections will generate more than $2 billion worth of political advertising on television. Our guest, Neil Oxman, has been making political ads for more than 30 years. He's a co-founder of the Campaign Group, a Philadelphia-based media firm that's managed ad campaigns in more than 700 races around the country. The firm's clients range from local office seekers to candidates for the House, Senate, and, in a few cases, the presidency. Oxman has made ads for Al Gore and for Jerry Springer when he was a mayor of Cincinnati running for governor. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies sat down with Neil Oxman to talk about how he makes political ads, what works and what doesn't, and how the business has changed since he got into it decades ago.
Neil Oxman, welcome to Fresh Air. You've done hundreds of elections. I've heard you say that in pretty much every campaign, there are three things you have to do.
The three things that you want to try to do in a campaign, if you're running a perfect campaign, is define yourself, meaning you define the candidate before your opponent defines him or herself. The second is define your opponent before the opponent defines himself or herself. And the third thing is you define the stakes of the election. You make the election about something most beneficial to you. Sometimes the stakes of the election are defined by major national issues. The Watergate year of 1974, the contract with America year of 1994, it's the economy stupid of 1992. I mean, there are seminal years in American politics where something is going on, and if you're in one party or the other, you might get wiped out or you might win regardless of what you do. The stakes of the election, if you can define it and make the campaign about something you want to make it about, is the best thing to do.
Sometimes it's not so obvious. I want to play an example of an ad that you brought, and I think this is a good example of an ad that defines the stakes. And this is an ad for Ronald Reagan. I guess probably this was in
1984. His reelection with Walter Mondale.
And it's about a bear. Why don't you just – before we listen to it, why don't you describe the visual, what's happening?
Ad done by this amazing ad guy, now passed away in California, named Hal Riney. You would know Hal Riney because he also did a lot of voiceover commercials. He did them for Gallo Wine. He did them for Alamo Rent-A-Car. I mean, he had this amazing voice. He's the guy who said in the Reagan commercials in 1984, "It's morning again in America." And he made, I think, one of the two greatest ads in American history, the first being Tony Schwartz's ad with the Daisy and Lyndon Johnson in 1964, which only ran once. And this ad where in a sort of very low tone, you hear the opening line that says there's a bear in the woods. And it's simply a picture of a bear and a hunter in silhouette. And the hunter has probably a shotgun. And the bear obviously represents Russia and or communism or the Soviet threat. And it's a vague reference to that, but it's really a way of saying Reagan was strong and Mondale wasn't strong about our national defense.
The fascinating thing is you see the bear moving around open terrain, and at the end he comes face to face with a hunter who does not level a weapon at him.
No,
and
he
the
does
question
not.
Is he prepared? Let's listen to this ad.
There is a bear in the woods. For some people, the bear is easy to see. Others don't see it at all. Some people say the bear is tame. Others say it's vicious and dangerous. Since no one can really be sure who's right, isn't it smart to be as strong as the bear? If there is a bear.
And I believe at the end of the ad, there's a card that says Ronald Reagan prepared for peace. And I mean, it was, I think, one of the two most brilliant ads made in the 60-year history of American political advertising.
I want to play an ad that you did for a mayor's race here in Philadelphia in 2007 for Michael Nutter, who is still the mayor of the city. And this was a race where you didn't run any negative ads, if I recall, except you might have criticized the previous mayor because I think you defined the stakes in that election as to who will take a different direction. Let's just listen to the ad for a moment.
My name is Olivia Nutter. This is my dad.
This is a house my dad grew up in West Philadelphia.
This is our dog.
This is my favorite food.
My dad's pretty cool for an old guy.
This is where I go to middle school.
My dad's the only Democrat for mayor with a child in the public schools.
I know he wants to make them better and safer.
My dad's pretty busy these days, but he still finds time to take me to school.
Have a good day.
Yep.
Be good.
The daughter of the candidate is the only voice, other than a brief mention of the mayor. Tell us your approach there.
Well, I saw Olivia and I thought, I'm going to use her in a spot somehow. And I wrote on my little pink message pad just her name. And then I wrote some copy and I ran it by Michael and the current mayor. And Nutter was in last place in a five-way primary. He was – the leader in the campaign was in the 30s and he was dead last at 7% of the vote with the least amount of money. And none of the candidates were sort of making the campaign about anything particularly relevant. And we decided to make the campaign a referendum on who would be least like the mayor who was there then, a guy named John Street. And we ran a couple of weeks of TV and we moved from last to second. But we were having a problem with African-American females who weren't connecting with – for some reason with Nutter. I could never figure out why. Michael Nutter is an African-American. And so we ran this ad. And when we did, he went into the lead and started doing overwhelmingly better with African-American females and won that quadrant of the vote very handily. Coincidentally, the guy who ran that campaign, Bill Hires, who did a terrific job, then ran Bill de Blasio's campaign for mayor in New York City last year, who came from behind and used his son in an ad, which is largely credited with getting de Blasio elected mayor. I don't know whether they stole our ad. I won't say they did. I think David Axelrod's firm did it. And nothing is original after the 1950s in political advertising, or 60s, I should say. So, but it really did work.
Everybody looks at everybody else's stuff. Now, you said that in the case of that ad, you needed to boost Nutter standing among African-American women. How much of what you do in designing and messaging ads is driven by polls and research?
All of it if you're smart. I mean, I don't mean that you take a poll and if somebody's – you can't do what Romney did. You can't just take a poll and sort of remake yourself. I mean, here's Mitt Romney who was pro-choice and pro-environment and pro-health care and governed like a liberal in Massachusetts and ran as a liberal and governed as a liberal and then wake up one day and say, I'm going to run for president and completely disband that. We don't take polls to tell a candidate what to do, what, you know, to change his opinion or her opinion about certain things. We take polls to sort of emphasize in certain areas. I mean, if you're running for governor of a state and the state is rural and urban, you're not necessarily running spots about farms in the urban part of the state. I mean, you have to be somewhat smart about that. And that, but what we try to do with ads is A, have the right message, meaning we're saying the right things, and B, of course, target that message to the right group of people.
You know, I don't see many ads in which candidates speak directly into the camera. And I would imagine that when you talk to candidates, a lot of them think they're pretty impressive people one-on-one and probably want to do that. When do you let a candidate talk into the camera?
If the candidate is good. I mean, because there are tricks you can do. You can have the candidate start talking and then you can cut away and use that as an audio edit or use that as a video edit if for some reason the candidate has blinked or looked weirdly into the monitor or whatever it is. And we do it. You're going to laugh at this, but we did Jerry Springer's campaign for governor of Ohio. Now, Jerry Springer was a young idealistic mayor of Cincinnati who got in trouble because he went into a house of ill repute in northern Kentucky and passed a check and got
– He paid for the services with a check.
Yes. But he runs for governor and my friend Mike Ford hired us to – Michael Ford, who just passed away, who was a great political operative in the United States, I mean one of the giants in this business, was running his campaign for governor of Ohio. And Michael said to my producer Mark Moskowitz, this guy can really talk to the camera but no one knows it. And most of the spots we had Springer talk to the camera. Well, when the campaign was over, Springer only got 15% of the vote. When the campaign was over, he lost the primary. The TV station in Cincinnati said to Springer, do you want to do editorial comments for us? And they said yes. And he started doing those and they made him the anchor. And that from there, he got a regional talk show and from there, he became Jerry Springer. Simply, I mean, literally because he talked to the camera in spots that we made for him in a losing gubernatorial campaign in Ohio in 1982, I think it was.
So as a campaign proceeds, things can get tough. Are there typical arguments you get into with a candidate about a media strategy? I mean, there must be tapes that go over and over in your head.
mostly about going negative, mostly about I want to do the campaign my way. I don't want to have to go negative. I mean, that's really what most of the fights are about. Of course, that immediately changes when you get attacked. And sometimes you don't have any notice. Now, sometimes we get notice because the ad gets trafficked to the TV station and somebody at the TV station, we get lucky and somebody calls us and says, or sometimes actually the campaigns preview the negative ads. But sometimes we'll get a call from the candidate, the candidate's wife, and, it's 7:18 and I'm just watching Jeopardy and they go crazy and that conversation goes entirely out the window. And so you have to just deal with it.
You brought a couple of other ads. This is an ad attacking Mark Pryor, who is – well, you explain who he is and who put this ad together.
Mark Pryor is the United States Senator from Arkansas running for reelection. And Karl Rove's independent committee, Crossroads, Karl Rove, who was the political genius behind George Bush and started up an independent committee and supports Republican candidates around the country, produced this ad that's running in Arkansas, ran in Arkansas this year against Mark Pryor's running for reelection in Arkansas. I think it's a terrific ad.
And it's an ad of a kid at a spelling bee. Right. Let's listen.
Your next word is Pryor.
May I have the definition, please?
Pryor, a Washington liberal out of touch with Arkansas, voted for the Obama agenda 90%.
May I hear it in a sentence?
Mark Pryor was the deciding vote for Obamacare.
Pryor, O-B-A-M-A.
Close enough.
American Crossroads is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Close enough, the judges say. Obama equals Pryor. Effective ad?
It's terrific because when you see it at the beginning, the ad looks exactly like everything you've seen for any spelling bee you've seen on national television or all the movies that do spelling bees. And it's a little girl sitting there and they do it in the exact format. And my guess is, not knowing the polling research, but my guess is that if you polled right now Barack Obama's name in Arkansas, it's obviously very negative, and equaling Mark Pryor to Barack Obama is not a good thing for Mark Pryor. But the effectiveness of the ad is how exactly close the ad looks like a real spelling bee thing. There's no phoniness about it. Really, this is a spelling bee.
So if you're Mark Pryor and that ad comes at you, what would you advise him to do?
That's a really hard ad to respond to, Dave, because the ad is so real. It's not a FACO ad in the sense that it's something in real life. But what you would probably do is you'd probably stop the ad and say, see this ad? These aren't real people. These are actors.
You'd run a piece of that ad and say, hold it.
These aren't real people. These are actors. And this isn't a real spelling bee. And Mark Pryor voted against Obama when he opposed Obama on this and this and this and this and this. Mark Pryor, an independent voice for Arkansas. I don't know if it would work because I thought that ad's one of the most effective ads I've seen in this cycle.
Not bad for a 15-second pitch. When you're doing a campaign, a congressional campaign, a Senate campaign, and somebody unleashes a hard-hitting attack ad on your opponent, is it better to respond by attacking your opponent or by doing an ad defending your candidate?
There's no rule, Dave. Every campaign is different. Every set of circumstances is different. Every part of the country is different. And a lot of it is some of it's science and some of it's poetry. Some of it's prose and poetry. I mean, some of it is where you sort of see where you are in the polls and whether you need to, take a 2x4 and kill the guy or whether you just sort of need to brush your opponent back a little bit and then go to the main message of what you have to talk about.
For years now, the media have been analyzing political ads and truth squatting them, right? Well, this claim doesn't quite hold up. That one's a half truth. If you're in the middle of a campaign and the media criticize the accuracy or fairness of your ad, do you care?
You used to care a lot more than you do now. One of the great tragedies, of course, that's happened in America is the slow demise of the American newspaper, where you know, if you ran for governor, senator in a state, and it was a big state, you'd have dozens of reporters sometimes following a campaign. Now you might have a handful. And so you don't have the same kind of local political coverage. You do in a mayor's race. You do clearly in a presidential campaign. But if you're running for Congress in this country, or you're running for the Senate, or you're running for governor, the kind of scrutiny you get from the free press is not nearly as acute as it used to be. And so sometimes you avoid it. Now, I've had people literally run ads against our clients saying that one of our clients raised taxes, voted to raise taxes in the legislature. Absolutely did not happen. Never voted – actually voted the other way. The press did do nothing because there was no press covering the campaign. And so, you know, sometimes so there was no truth squad out there saying it you know, this ad of our opponent was wrong. I mean, so you try to do truthful things in campaigns, and you want to make sure that you want to make sure what you're saying in a campaign doesn't come back to haunt you. That's the number one goal of what you want to do. You don't want to become an issue in the campaign.
How has the business changed in the 35 years you've been doing it?
Well, the biggest thing is Citizens United and money. I mean, 30 years ago when we started, a good congressional campaign in any district in America might spend $200,000 on TV. Now a good congressional campaign in any place in America spends $2 to $3 million on TV, certainly way beyond the cost of inflation. I mean, unbelievably beyond the cost of inflation, even beyond the cost of way college tuitions have gone up. I mean, the cost of American television has exceeded every year the cost of inflation by many times. So what you used to be able to buy an ad in some media market on the Today Show for X, and now to get less of an audience on the Today Show in the same market cost five times X. So money is the biggest single thing. And then, of course, now it's all the independent expenditures. I don't know whether independent expenditures this year, meaning independent committees raising money away from a campaign itself, the candidates' campaigns themselves, will spend as much money as all the campaigns combined. But we're getting to the point where it's really close, where everybody I know who does this business are doing as much business in their own firms, you know, from independent committees as they are from clients.
So the people who are hiring you to make ads aren't candidates.
No,
often. They are independent committees who are funded by
right.
Because unions or corporations
or
individuals. Or ideological.
Exactly, because the reporting rules are a lot different. And you can have it's not about personal money. You can give corporate money. And so if somebody goes to a friend and says, hey, give me $100,000 from your corporation, if it's a privately held corporation, instead of $2,500 from you, and this $100,000 is never going to be reported, that's why so much of this independent money is being raised.
And so if the court decisions now mean there are these independent groups who have a lot of money to put into political advertising, does the character of the advertising itself change? If it's not the candidate putting their name to it, does it mean
it's become much more negative. The ratio of negative to positive has gotten much higher.
Campaigns can be pretty intense, particularly in the last 2 or 3 weeks. How quickly can you turn around a response ad?
You get attacked. You make a response ad in a relatively few hours, and then you put it up on satellite and it gets to the TV stations right away. So if you're attacked on a Monday and you find out Monday morning, you can pretty much be – Tuesday morning you can be on with a response ad. The biggest lag time actually is once the ad gets to the TV stations, how quickly they log the ad in at the TV station and they put it in rotation into their sort of commercial cycle. Weekends are really bad, which is why you'll see a lot of attack ads start after noon on Friday, because the weekends often you're not able to respond, and so they get sort of a 48 or 60 free hours before you can respond by Monday.
Because the TV stations are thinly staffed on weekends.
Absolutely.
And they just can't turn them
around. And they'll tell you that, you know, there's no one there. And the other thing is that some people at the TV stations make mistakes and they run the wrong ads. That happens all the time. They log in the wrong ads. And oh, my Lord, an attack ad is running and you don't want it to run. And you've started out – I mean, it's literally like starting a nuclear war. Somebody's pressed the wrong button. That's literally what's happened. Somebody's pressed the wrong button. It started a gigantic war in the campaign, and you didn't mean to run it because somebody making $12 an hour at a TV station literally put a wrong computer term in, and that was it, the wrong ad ran.
And that's happened in the campaign.
It's happened to us. It's happened to our opponents. It happens all the time.
Are TV ads still the most effective way to move votes?
Yes. I mean, 10 years ago, of course, there was no part of a campaign. I mean, if you looked at a campaign structure from 10 years ago, you had a campaign manager, and you had a press secretary, and you had an issues director, and you had a scheduler, and you had a field director, and you had a traveling person. Now you have a whole social media department. And so when you looked at a budget from 10 years ago, there was zero money for social media. Now a legitimate percentage of a campaign is spent on everything around social media. But the biggest predictor of voting is age. The second biggest predictor of voting is, of course, is income, education. But still in America today, the greatest predictor of how somebody's going to – if somebody's going to vote is how old they are, which is why in presidential campaigns you get 25 or 30 million more people vote than in the non-presidential, because people under 30 just don't come out in these by-elections. And older people watch TV. They're much more passive about how they get their information. They sit in front of the television. They don't flick away from commercials. They watch TV. Kids today don't watch TV on TV. They watch it on every other thing they can get. They watch it on their phones. They watch it on their iPads. They watch it on computers. But television is still, in most campaigns, the largest single expenditure you'll see in that campaign, whether somebody runs for mayor of a big city, Congress, governor, senator, or president, but maybe not president, but at least those statewide offices and Congress will be television and radio expenditures.
So at least for a few more years, people need you.
Hopefully.
Neil Oxman is campaign media consultant and the co-founder of the Campaign Group. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is also senior news reporter at WHYY. You'll find a longer version of their conversation online at freshair.npr.org. The chief songwriter for the Canadian-based rock band The New Pornographers, A.C. Newman, calls the band's new album, Brill Bruisers, a celebration record. He's quoted as saying, "After periods of difficulty, I am at a place where nothing in my life is dragging me down, and the music reflects that." Rock critic Ken Tucker listened to Brill Bruisers to figure out what Newman meant.
The eight members of the New Pornographers have each conducted separate careers. For example, singer-songwriter Nico Case works as a solo artist, and singer-guitarist Dan Behar has his band Destroyer. But under the guidance of ad hoc leader Alan Carl A.C. Newman, the New Pornographers combine to form something much different than the sum of its parts. In the case of this album, Brill Bruisers, it's a collection of lushly arranged and harmonized pop. For all the straightforwardness of the music, Newman has a fondness for teasingly elliptical lyrics. I cheerfully admit I don't know what the lyric of Fantasy Fools means, but the music, especially as it barrels into the chorus, communicates a happiness that I find exhilarating no matter how many times I play it.
Here come the motion seekers. Backyard dreams of the deep best secrets. The motion seekers.
As you can hear from that song, The New Pornographers is making music whose influences are fun to figure out. I hear some ABBA in the harmonies, some ELO in the keyboards. On other songs, there's everything from the playful, pompous rock of Queen to the soulful harmonies of the Mamas and the Papas, emanating from the contributions of strong vocalist Catherine Calder, among others. Which means, ultimately, that this band is creating its own sound, using the time-tested pop culture method of picking and choosing from anything and everything, recombined for original effects.
Last night I dreamt Vancouver dressed up in the ocean. Last night I dreamt Victoria drowned in the ocean. The right of a lifetime, the rights of spring of a lifetime. The right of a lifetime, the rights of spring of a lifetime.
If you separate out the individual members of this band, each has made his or her share of moody, morose, even despairing music. Indeed, it has sometimes seemed as though the voice of Nico Case, low and rumbling, was made for conjuring up melancholy. But there's a brightness and light that emanates from these musicians when they become the new Pornographers. Although Newman does most of the songwriting on Brill Bruisers, the working out of the arrangements and each song's instrumental effects comes across as very much collaborative efforts, whether they are or not. The result is a band in harmony in every sense. One thing that the title song suggests is that the band is using Brill in the British slang manner, as short for brilliant. A.C. Newman also wants you to make the association with the Brill Building, the Manhattan edifice that housed famous songwriting teams in the 60s. The band is even going to give a concert in the lobby of that building to promote this album. But the brilliant bruisers cited in the song's lyrics are stand-ins for the group members themselves. Music industry pros who take pride in a muscular professionalism, in being prolific and, when need be, pugnacious. It's what gives a song such as Backstairs a real punch.
Before I knew to choose the music of celebrity, I sang backups on the backstairs, the backstairs, the backstairs. I wore a groove, sneaking around the servants' quarters so, so I knew my way around the back stairs. There is another west, you'll find out. It's near the thunderous. There is another west, much wilder. We feel it under us, and yet another west, a new one.
So to circle back to A.C. Newman's declaration that Brill Bruisers is a celebration record, well, yes, there's a frequently thrilling exuberance to the music here, the satisfaction to be savored of a band having worked hard over the course of 2 years to make the full flowering of any given song sound like spontaneous growth, which is just one measure of the growth of the band itself, a maturity that is confident enough to make capturing the sound of immature joy sound like the art it is.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Brill Bruisers, the latest album from the New Pornographers. Coming up, Dana Goldstein talks about her new book, The Teacher Wars, a history of America's most embattled profession. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Dana Goldstein, author of the new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Goldstein writes about how teaching became, quote, the most controversial profession in America, unquote, and how teachers have become, in her words, both resented and idealized. Although the book is largely a history, it also draws on Goldstein's reporting on recent controversies surrounding teaching. She's reported on education for several years in such places as The Atlantic and The Daily Beast. Goldstein received a Spencer Fellowship in Education Journalism from Columbia University. Her father was a public school teacher.
Dana Goldstein, welcome to Fresh Air. So the subtitle of your book is A History of America's Most Embattled Profession, and your book starts with the observation that public school teaching has become the most controversial profession in America. What are the most controversial parts of teaching now?
Well, I've been covering education as a journalist since 2007, and one of the things I noticed, especially after the recession hit in 2008 and coming into President Obama's administration, was we were having a big national conversation about inequality. And teaching was something that was discussed again and again as a potential fix, for inequality, something that could, you know, help poor children achieve like middle-class children and close these socioeconomic gaps that we're so concerned about as a nation. And I think because our expectations on teachers are so high, we are constantly disappointed. And this this is the crux of why it is a controversial and embattled profession.
So what you're saying is teachers are expected to fix society's cultural and economic problems, and that's a hard job.
Yes, it is. And, you know, we have a relatively weak social safety net outside our schools compared to other Western countries. And, you know, what surprised me and was so interesting about doing research on 200 years of teaching in America was that we have always had these high expectations. This idea that teachers have a role to play in fighting poverty and inequality has been with us since the early 19th century.
Well, let's go back to the 1800s and talk a little bit about how the teaching profession developed into what it is today. When I went to public schools in the late 1950s and the 1960s, my teachers, most of them were women. I had a few men, but certainly in my elementary school, I think there was one man teacher. But he wasn't there the whole time that I was in school. And in junior high, mostly women. High school, more of a mix. And you go back to the 1820s. I think all this explains how teaching became a kind of low-paid profession because it was women, so you could get away with that.
Yes. So a lot of people are surprised to learn that back in 1800, 90% of American teachers were actually male. And today we know that 76% of teachers are females. So how did this huge flip happen, the gender dynamic that you experienced, Terry, as a child, and that most of us did? And the answer is that as school reformers began to realize in the 1820s that schooling should be compulsory, that parents should be forced to send their kids to school, and public education should be universal, they had to come up with a way to do this basically in an affordable manner, because raising taxes was just about as unpopular back then as it is now. So what we see is a sort of alliance between politicians and education reformers in the early 19th century to redefine teaching as a female profession. And they do this in a couple ways. First, they argue that women are more moral in a Christian sense than men. And they depict men as sort of alcoholic, sort of lash-wielding, horrible teachers who are abusive to children. And they make this argument that women can do a better job because they're more naturally suited to spend time with kids, almost on a biological level. And then they also are quite explicit about the fact that, hey, we can pay women about 50% as much, and this is going to be a great thing for the taxpayer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dana Goldstein. We're talking about her new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Let's talk a little bit about the history of teachers' unions. When do teachers first organize into a union?
So the teachers' union movement dates back to about 1897, and it is born in Chicago. And what we see at the time is 97% of Chicago teachers are female. And yet we have a reform community in the city of Chicago that's led by William Rainey Harper, the president of the University of Chicago, that is very concerned with bringing more male educators into the profession. So first, in the early 19th century, we had this push to make teaching a female profession. 100 years later, reformers are saying, maybe this was not such a good idea. We have all these uneducated women teaching. They're not tough enough to do the job. We have 60 student classrooms. Do women really have the starch? Do they have the guts necessary to deal with these big classrooms full of immigrant kids? And so what they decide to do is lower women teacher salaries in Chicago in order to attract more men and pay men more. And the female teachers organize. They launch the Chicago Teachers Federation, and they say, this is just simply not fair. We're not going to stand for this.
So teachers don't get the right to collective bargain until the 1960s. So what happened to the union that it became strong enough to get that?
Well, public sector unionization happened, and laws were passed that allowed collective bargaining in the public sector. So that was the really big thing.
One of the most controversial issues in education today is the standards and accountability movement, the increase in the number of standardized tests that students have to take, how teachers are evaluated based on the results of those tests, how schools are evaluated based on the results of those tests. You trace that movement back to President Reagan. What does he initiate that starts off that movement?
So President Reagan appointed a guy named Terrell Bell to be his Secretary of Education. And Terrell Bell appoints a commission that writes a report called A Nation at Risk. And A Nation at Risk says that American schools are failing, that the Japanese and the Russians and the Chinese are overtaking us, especially in math and science. And they blame quite a bit of this on teachers. And they call for some big changes.
What changes?
Well, they ask states to institute standardized testing programs so that we can really see how the states and how the children are doing. And we see most of the states respond and start these big standardized testing pushes. And with all this data that comes in, all these kids' test scores, we see this education reform push and this panic about achievement gaps gather steam. And it is all this data that people start to use to ask the question, hey, can we look at kids' test scores and use that to judge teachers? And from this, we see the development of what today is called value-added measurement of teachers, which is the practice developed by economists of taking kids' test scores and using that to draw conclusions about the individual classroom teacher.
So if you're a teacher today in a public school, what kind of standardized testing do you have to keep up with?
No Child Left Behind, which was President George W. Bush's policy, required annual testing in reading and math in third through eighth grades, as well as in high school. So this was sort of the first time that the federal government asked states to test kids every single year, and immediately teachers felt a lot more pressure around these test scores than they ever had before. President Obama has taken that a step further. With his No Child Left Behind tweaks and his reform program Race to the Top, he has asked states, if they want federal funding, to grade every single teacher who's working based on whether or not they improve student performance. And what most schools and states have decided to do in order to get that money is to institute more testing so that they can measure teachers' work. So we see what I really believe and what I write about in the book as the moment in American history that is more obsessed with standardized testing than any other. And even though there was a big testing push during the 1920s, I really truly believe that we have more focus on tests today than ever before.
What are some of the frustrations you see teachers having faced with these standardized tests?
They don't like what it's doing to the curriculum. So a teacher that I interviewed in Colorado, for example, she teaches elementary school art, and she would like to be creating art with her kids, painting and drawing and sculpture. But instead, she's actually lecturing them to prepare them for a multiple choice test in art that they're going to take, which asks questions like, what colors do you see up on the blackboard? And, you know, what are the qualities of a line? And she said to me, you know, some of those things are good things to teach kids, but when they come into class and I say, you're going to be taking a multiple choice test today or preparing for a multiple choice test today instead of creating art, she just really worries about what that's doing to their passion for her subject, whether they like coming to school. And you see that kids are having 25, 30 standardized testing days per year. This is a big chunk of the time kids are spending in school.
Let's talk about another very controversial aspect of teaching today, which is tenure. Why is tenure so controversial today?
Well, tenure is so controversial because it provides greater job security than almost any other American who's not a teacher has. And when I interviewed Randy Weingarten, who's the head of the National Teachers Union, the American Federation of Teachers, about this, she said, oh, yeah, I mean, we are so privileged compared to most workers. I mean, she totally just admits that. And so this is why tenure is controversial. People say, I don't have this sort of protection. You know, if my boss wants to fire me, he can just come in on Monday and just fire me. Why should teachers deserve more than that? And I do think there are some good arguments why, but often the conversation gets boiled down to something very simplistic.
Why does tenure exist? What are the roots of tenure?
A tenure dates back to 1909, and at the time it was something that school reformers and teachers' unions actually agreed about. They looked over at the Prussian, the German education system, which was very admired in the United States at the time, and they noticed that teachers there had more job security, and that the sort of low pay that teachers earn was offset by the promise that you could hold on to your job for a long time and that you would get a pension at the end when you retired. So school reformers and unions wanted to bring this system to the United States, especially because at the time it was not unusual for teachers to be laid off or fired for very bad reasons, such as they were pregnant, they were black, they didn't get along with the mayor. These were all very typical occurrences back then.
Can we add to that list having unpopular political views?
Yes, absolutely. This happened all the time. And teachers who opposed standardized testing or IQ testing, which was very popular at that time, were often retaliated against.
So where do you see tenure heading now? Are there compromises that people are talking about between the current system and ending tenure altogether?
Well, two-thirds of the states have weakened their tenure laws in response to President Obama's Race to the Top program. So tenure as it existed back then, it doesn't hardly exist anymore. We see states passing laws that say if a teacher gets two bad evaluations in a row, this teacher loses their tenure protection. So this is the status quo in many states, and it's becoming more and more the status quo. So there is a national push right now to sue to make tenure totally illegal. We saw that in California with the Vergara case that was ruled in June. Now we see two copycat lawsuits in New York. The advocates are saying they're going to bring this across the country. And what I keep saying as well, we're in this national sort of slower-moving collaborative process in which teachers' unions are coming to the table to reassess tenure. Is everyone going to sort of go back into the corner and get scared because it's now becoming this aggressive fight in the courts?
I want to move on to charter schools, which are also very controversial now. What was the initial ideal of a charter school?
The initial idea of the charter school, which was fully supported by Al Shanker, the National Teachers Union head back in the 1980s, was that it would be a teacher-led school. So teams of teachers would start an innovative new school that was freed from a lot of intervention from government to try new ideas. And when they tried these new ideas, other schools would look and see and would adopt those best practices. That was the original idea. It didn't really turn out that way.
So compare that to the charter school movement now.
The charter school movement is now dominated by non-unionized schools. The people who start charter schools tend not to be teams of teachers, but to be sort of reformers who come into it from an administrative perspective with a much more top-down vision. We see big networks like the KIPP network, Achievement First, launching national charter school chains. These are mostly nonprofits, but some are for-profit schools. One other thing that's important to note about charter schools is a lot of them have adopted a pedagogical stance called no excuses. And this combines a sort of back-to-basic curriculum, a lot of focus on standardized test prep in many of these schools, and strict discipline, sometimes uniforms for kids. So not all charter schools are that way. There are some very progressive charter schools, but the sort of popular image of a charter school is very much in this no excuses, non-unionized vein.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dana Goldstein. We're talking about her new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. a recommendation that you make at the end of your book. You say, make teaching an attractive, challenging job that intelligent, creative, and ambitious people will gravitate toward. Is there something that you think is holding back many intelligent, creative, and ambitious people from becoming teachers?
Yes. The profession is very flat in two senses. First, it's flat in terms of pay. So, for example, over the first 5 years of a teacher's career here in New York City, you can earn about a $5,000 raise. In North Carolina, it takes 15 years to jump from $30,000 to $40,000. And this is pretty astounding. In most other professions, over the course of your 20s and 30s, you can make some big leaps in terms of your salary. We're asking teachers to wait many, many decades to achieve that upper middle class salary. So the flat pay, especially early in the career, that's something that we need to deal with. Secondly, it's flat in terms of opportunities for advancement. We don't give teachers the opportunity to grow their level of responsibility without becoming, say, a principal. So I've been talking a little bit about teachers mentoring one another, and that's one really important thing we can do. We need to offer teachers the opportunity to be recognized as leaders while them remaining in the classroom, working with kids, working with other adults as well.
Anything else you would really like to see, any other reforms you'd really like to see in the school system?
Well, I think something that's very important to talk about and doesn't get talked about these days as much as it should is the fact that our school system is so deeply segregated. So we have almost half of Black and Latino children in deeply segregated schools, and we know these schools experience the most turnover in terms of teachers and administrators. They struggle very much with retaining staff. And there are good models for integrating our schools. It has to come from a combination of housing policy, making sure that low-income housing is dispersed throughout cities and throughout regions and not clustered. And it can also come through things like charter schools and magnet schools, schools that draw their student populations from a broader area as opposed to just one neighborhood. When these two sort of things, education and housing policy, work together, we can do more to create socioeconomically and racially integrated schools through choice. And this is really important because the mid-century desegregation movement in the United States really got tripped up on busing and the fact that people were being bused who did not want to be bused. And there are better models these days, and I think it's very important that we look at those.
Dana Goldstein is the author of the new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yoe Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.